evening, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. And to the end of another broadcast week, we have this last half hour together before the weekend, and then we will take some time off. For me, that goes by very quickly. That is, the week does. And what goes by even more quickly is the half hour each day that we spend together here from 9:30 to 10. It really goes by fast because what it is, it's a live program. And live talk shows usually are not a half hour long. They're usually longer. And so we get in as many calls as we can, and it does go by very fast. But I'm glad to have this time with you each morning. If you're interested in a longer version of the program, on the Internet, you can catch my afternoon program, which is an hour, which is also called The Narrow Path. Same name. I do the program twice a day, a half hour in the mornings and an hour in the afternoons, and you can catch the program live or later from our website, which is thenarrowpath.com. Now, this program is here for you to call in if you have questions about the Bible or about Christianity, or if you have a disagreement with the host and would like to bring that up. I welcome you to call this number. It's 1-800-227-5278. Let me give that again. It's 1-800-227-5278. I guess I'm a little dyslexic here. All right, and we have some lines open for you, although we're going to be talking to callers right away. 1-800-227-5278. Our first caller is Rosalie from Montclair, California. And Rosalie, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling me.
Hi, thank you for taking the call. My question was, Lucifer has the name Morning Star, and it's kind of confusing to me because I thought that Jesus also was called by that name, maybe Bright Morning Star.
That's correct.
So I know that somebody was going to go to a church, and that church has the name Morning Star in it, and the guy was confused and said, I don't think I want to go there, and I didn't know what to answer him. And I wonder that if it's your thinking that over time the way people interpret things, I think they get confused or lost. Things get lost in the correct translation.
The term Morning Star is used of two individuals in the Bible. It is used of Christ in Revelation chapter 22. He says, I am the bright, the morning star. And because it is used of Christ, it certainly cannot be objectionable for a church to call itself some name that has the term Morning Star in it. Yes. Clearly, that is a biblical term for Christ. But as you pointed out, there is another person called the Morning Star, and that is in Isaiah chapter 14 and verse 12. Now, that person is often identified with Satan in popular thinking, although Isaiah does not say it's Satan. There's actually nothing in the Bible that says that individual is Satan. Instead, in that chapter, it says that the individual being addressed is the king of Babylon. The king of Babylon is addressed in Isaiah 14:4. And then in the same chapter, in verse 12, he is referred to as the Morning Star. Now, for some strange reason, traditionally the King James Version left the term untranslated. That means Morning Star. And it appears in the King James Version as the name Lucifer. Now, the word Lucifer is just a foreign word that means Morning Star. It's not really a proper name. And the word Lucifer appears only once in the Bible anywhere, and that's in Isaiah 14:12. And in that passage, according to the context, it's referring to the king of Babylon. But there was a teacher in the early church named Tertullian who suggested that Lucifer is actually a name for the devil. And that caught on. And so there's been a tradition in the church for hundreds of years that Lucifer is actually a name for Satan. Now, the Bible doesn't say that. The Bible only uses the word Lucifer once, and that is with a reference to the king of Babylon in Isaiah chapter 14. Now, it is a tradition of most Christians to believe that Isaiah 14 is talking about Satan, but Isaiah does not anywhere say that this is so. And so it would look to me, if we're just going to use the Bible as our source, that we would have to say that the king of Babylon in Isaiah 14 is called Morning Star, and that Jesus is called Morning Star. And that would suggest to me that the term Morning Star can be a generic term of maybe a flattery to a king. Many times people would call kings by flowery titles, and Jesus is called by many kingly titles. In fact, do you know the king of Babylon is also called the King of Kings. In Daniel chapter 2, Daniel is speaking to Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. He says, "You are the King of Kings." And yet we know Jesus is called the King of Kings. Now, what do we make of this? Of course, I'm not saying that Jesus is the King of Babylon. What I'm saying is these terms apparently can be used of royalty more generically, so that certain terms of royalty, like King of Kings, or like Morning Star, and perhaps other royal titles, have been used of earthly kings, like the King of Babylon at times, but they are in the New Testament applied to Jesus because he is the ultimate king, and so all the traditional titles of royalty are also applied to him in the New Testament. And so I'm going to suggest that the term Morning Star, in both of its occurrences in the Bible, is simply a term of royalty. It is applied to the King of Babylon in the Old Testament, and it is applied to Jesus in the New Testament. And for all we know, although we don't have record of it, it might have been used of other kings at other times as well. So that's where I would stand on that. And therefore, if a church had the term Morning Star in its name, I would not necessarily find any objection to that, because, again, in Revelation 20, Jesus calls himself the Morning Star, and therefore the term could hardly be objectionable.
That's great. I can let him know that. I didn't know what... Yeah. I mean, I understood where he was coming from and his concern, but it's a Christian church, you know. I mean, and there's so mm-hmm. many. All he had to do was...
Okay. Well, I hope that helps.
He could have, but yes, I thank you so much for your
okay.
time.
Bye-bye. God bless you. Bye now. If you'd like to be on the show, the number to call is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. You're listening to The Narrow Path. Our next caller is James, calling from Los Angeles. James, welcome to The Narrow Path. I think you tried to reach me yesterday and we didn't have time.
Right. Thank you. I appreciate it. Good morning to you.
Sure. Glad to have
I'd you. Like to... thank you very much. I'd like to first start with a small historical mention of Islam in its early days and how it currently conducts itself in those Islamic countries.
Okay, if we could be quick. It could be a long story.
No, it's very brief. Okay. It's relating to the Book of Revelations with a mark on the forehead. You know, okay. In the Islamic form of prayer, they have to tap their forehead against a small clay a cylinder that they place on the ground, and they have to... When they have to, the men, I don't know if the women do that, I've never paid attention. The men develop a big bruise on their forehead, right between their eyes, above their eyes. And that's considered the sign of a devout Muslim. And if you go to Saudi Arabia, even nowadays, or the Islamic countries, Egypt, or I've seen it in Egypt a bit, they have that mark on their forehead. And if they don't have that mark on their forehead, they have restricted privileges in buying and selling. And in the ancient days, when Islam first took over, and then when the Islam ruled most of the Middle East, and the Christians, of course, had to be subjugated under the Muslims, the Christians obviously did not have that mark on their forehead, and they were segregated in public for public services, buying and selling and what have you, owning property. And so I find that interesting that in the Revelations, they predicted that the mark on the forehead, and if they don't have the mark on the forehead, they won't be able to buy and sell, because that's exactly the way it was conducted in to the Christians in the Islamic areas after the rise of Islam. And
I see. Yeah. Well, let me just jump in here, because it sounds like I said, this could be a long story, and we have only a short radio program. I'm going to agree with you on one thing, and that is that Islam is an antichrist religion. It says in 1 John, in fact, where the term antichrist is defined, is in the book of 1 John. And in 1 John chapter 2, verse 22, it says, "Who is a liar but he who denies that Jesus is the Messiah?" That person is antichrist, who denies the Father and the Son. And so John tells us that anybody who denies that Jesus is the Messiah is Antichrist. In fact, there's no other definition of Antichrist given in Scripture. The term Antichrist is found only in 1 John and in 2 John. The term is not found in the book of Revelation or any other book of the Bible. Just 1 and 2 John have the word Antichrist. And John tells us anyone who denies that Jesus is the Christ is Antichrist. And that means that, of course, Islam would be a religion that is Antichrist because they deny that Jesus is the Christ. On the other hand, so do all other religions. And so all religions other than Christianity are Antichrist. Now, as far as the mark on the head and on the hand that Revelation 13 talks about, there have been many different suggestions as to the fulfillment of that, both in the present and in the past. And there have been a lot of different ways in which the mark on the forehead and the hand have been applied to things that are anti-Christian, like Islam. What you're suggesting is one of them. Now, I myself have a slightly different understanding of the term, the mark on the hand and the forehead in Revelation 13. But on a show this length, I don't have time to survey all the possible meanings, because there are a great number of them. But you certainly have made your point, and I appreciate you calling about it, because that's what I encourage people to do.
All right. But just remember, I wasn't saying that Muslims are bad people, generally speaking.
Okay,
I was just trying to
talk
about the mark on the forehead and try to tie that into the Bible.
Of course, yeah, and that's true. We don't want to suggest that people of other religions are all evil people, because any more than anyone else, I mean, all people, I suppose, could be called evil in one sense. We're all sinners, but we're not trying to pick on the Muslims particularly as worse than other people. The real issue of the question of Antichrist is, does one acknowledge that Jesus is the Christ or not? And John says if someone denies that Jesus is the Christ, then that person is Antichrist. That sounds rather severe, but that's just what the Bible says. And so if we're going to even talk about the word Antichrist, it would do well to use the Bible's definition, since that's the book we get the word from. Let's talk to Will, calling from Manteca, California. And we also have a line open for you if you'd like to call. If you have a question about the Bible or a difference of opinion from the host and want to call, the number is 1-800-227-5278. You're listening to The Narrow Path. We are live from 9:30 to 10 in the morning. And if you're listening at that time, you can get through right now, 1-800-227-5278. My name is Steve Gregg, and our caller is Will from Manteca. Welcome to The Narrow Path, Will.
Hi. My question has to do with God's foreknowledge. My main concern about it is when God makes us, whether he looks down the corridor of time to see what our reactions will be, or whether he determines that ahead of time, you know, there are many views on that. My main concern is when he does make us, obviously he knows how every thing that he puts into us, as far as whether we call it programming or just our own temperament, because, you know, some people seem to have more of a temperance to go toward the Lord or to be it gets real confusing there, but the question I have is when God does programming, he knows exactly how that's going to affect it. It's almost as if programming a computer would be for myself. I give it the parameters it reacts to. Therefore, he could make one person more or less apt to go toward him. So I guess I'm just trying to reconcile that. How does that work, and would that then be predestination in a way, because he knows that he's making us a certain way ahead of time?
Well, you know, I really don't know that we could say that God does program us in that sense. Certainly our DNA is sort of like a computer program, although that DNA has not been fashioned individually for us, but it's been passed down from our parents and our grandparents, our great-grandparents, and so forth. I mean, our DNA does determine our physical characteristics and probably our mental acuity and things like that. It's hard to know how much that is controlled by DNA. But the matter of choosing to be a rebel against God or to submit to God, a choice to follow the truth or to suppress the truth because we find it inconvenient, that kind of a choice I don't think is programmed into us. Now, I agree with you that for some reason, some people from birth appear to be more, rebellious, more stubborn, seemingly less likely to follow God when given a chance. And they seem to have that kind of built into their temperament. I mean, some babies are just born with a different temperament than others. And where that comes from, I don't know. I don't know if that temperament is a something in the DNA, or if that's something that God has, you know, it's a challenge that God has given that person to overcome. Everyone has some kind of challenge to overcome, and with some, it's a surly disposition that they seem to have from birth that they have to overcome. We all have sin. And all of us, therefore, I think, are probably disposed to resist truth in some measure. But I will agree with you that some people, and in circumstances that we could probably just attribute to God's sovereignty, are born perhaps in circumstances or with a emotional kit that makes them more likely to become a Christian. But even that doesn't determine that they will. You know, some people say, well, you know, you're just a Christian because you're born in America, you're raised in a Christian family, and, you know, if you're born in Saudi Arabia, you'd be a Muslim. Well, maybe I would be. Maybe I would be a Muslim because I might not know of any other religion than Islam. But it's not a given. Just because a person's born with a certain set of influences in their life doesn't mean that they have no choice in the matter. There are Arabs who have become Christians, and there are people raised in Christian families who become atheists. So one really can't say that anything that about a person's birth or birth condition necessarily can predict accurately whether they're going to follow God or not. I think that is a matter of free choice. Now, as far as God's foreknowledge about that, that's a different issue, and that's the first point you raised up. How God knows what we will do is never really told to us. Some people think God's outside of time. Like you said, it can look down the corridors of time or whatever. Other people feel that God determines an awful lot of what goes on in time and has other ways of, you know, calculating the trajectory of a person's behavior to know what they'll do in the future. The Bible really never explains how God knows. I think the Bible does affirm, though, that God knows what we're going to do. But I don't think it affirms anything that would tell us exactly how he has that knowledge. That's somehow innate in him. And I can't really answer that mystery.
Okay, that makes sense. I guess it's just a matter of, I look at it as, if he does see our every move based on whatever personality he gives us, I believe that's our spirit that he gives us. And each person is different, whether it be based on how they're raised or the way they're born, because like you said, even a newborn baby in the exact same condition will have a different personality. And it's just strange how, you know, I've done studies on it where more women are apt to go toward the Lord. And is it because God gave them a lesser of a rebellious spirit? And I understand there's not much of an answer for that, but
right.
thanks for your help.
Difficult.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's difficult, if not impossible, to answer some of those questions. They're searching and important questions, but I don't know if we can get the answers to those. You mentioned that you feel like a person's disposition from birth is part of their spirit, and that seems entirely possible. It seems possible that a person's individual temperament or personality is very much largely dished out to them by God right at the beginning. Although, again, I don't know how much of that is genetic. I don't know how much of that comes into their environment from their environment to them. Those are very complex questions, and they're good ones, but I'm afraid it's above my pay grade to answer all of that.
No, I totally understand. I also asked you before what if Adam wouldn't have sinned, and I know I got a lot of weird questions in that sense, but they're definitely fascinating. Thank you so much for your help. I appreciate it.
There are a lot of hard questions out there, and I don't know all the answers, but I appreciate your calling, Will.
Thank you very much.
God bless
Bye-bye.
You. Yeah, God bless. Okay, we'll talk next to Abraham from Los Angeles also. Last caller was from Los Angeles, so is this one. Hi, Abraham. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Good morning, Steve.
Hi.
I'm turning into a regular caller now, but I had another question for you.
All right.
I was looking at a couple of YouTube videos, and I saw a video of Horus, the Egyptian god, sun god.
Yeah.
And in comparison to Jesus, how true is that? Is that actual fact?
No, it's not true at all. Did you watch the video Zeitgeist?
Uh-huh.
Was it the video that's called Zeitgeist?
Yes, I watched it was a 9-minute video on just that part, I guess.
Oh, 9-minute one. Okay, there's a two hour video on the internet that millions of people have watched called Zeitgeist, and it talks about Horus, it talks about Mithras, it talks about Krishna, it talks about Dionysius, and talks about a lot of the pagan gods. And it tries to point out many parallels between them and the stories of Jesus. And the point they're trying to make is that the story of Jesus is just as mythological as these other mythological god stories are. And the
right.
parallels they try to point out, they say that these gods were said to be born of a virgin, that they walked on water, that they collected 12 disciples and wandered around with them. They did miracles and healed the sick and turned water into wine. That they died on a cross, were dead 3 days, and rose again to life, and so forth. Now, you know, that's a pretty good summary of the story of Jesus, okay? But is it really a good summary of the story of Horus, or Dionysius, or Krishna? How many of those features of the life of Jesus really exist in the myths about these other gods? The answer is approximately zero. There are a few cases in these myths where there might be some aspect of the myth of Horus or of Mithras that has some very tenuous similarity to something in the story of Jesus. But this wholesale similarity comparison they make is 100% fabricated. Now, I actually have made 2 hours worth of video, which you can see on the internet for free. You can go to YouTube and find it. Look up my name, Steve Gregg. My last name is spelled G-R-E-G-G, Steve Gregg, and put in the word Zeitgeist. It's Z, as in zebra, E-I-T-G-E-I-S-T, Zeitgeist. It's a German word. What you'll find is that I've done a two-hour teaching debunking the Zeitgeist video, which has a lot to do with Horus and these other gods that are mentioned. So if you're interested, the short answer to your question is no, it's entirely a lie. There are no such similarities between Horus and Jesus. But rather than just deny it without backing it up, I would direct you to the Zeitgeist video. Not the Zeitgeist video, but my videos where I debunk Zeitgeist. A couple of hours of lectures.
Okay, yeah, well, sounds good, Steve. I mean, I go with 100% of what you say always. And I just wanted to make a special request. Tomorrow I'll be 6 years married, my anniversary, and I would love, really appreciate it. Thank you. I would love if you can pray for me, Steve. That's all. I'll hang up now.
All right. God bless you, Abraham.
Thank you, Steve.
I will. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought we were done. I hung up. I didn't mean to cut you off. Yeah, I will pray for you and your wife, and I hope that other listeners will do the same. Congratulations on 6 years of marriage. Let's talk to Manuel, calling from Turlock, California. Hi, Manuel. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hello, sir. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
I heard moments ago a conversation about the mark in the forehead.
Yes, uh-huh.
And I think it was not very well explained in your part, and I would talk about it. If it is possible, and I want to ask...
Well, we don't have very much time. We only have a few minutes. But what is it you want to point out?
Well, if you didn't explain it, I feel the need that it's going to be explained. The mark in the forehead is in the forehead, is in your brain. It's inside. And it's or a good one or a bad one. The Lord puts mark in his elect, which are the seals. He doesn't put in everybody, only in his elect. He tells them the truth. And the mark in the forehead by Satan is the seed. And if they accept the seed, which means what is not the truth, and okay. the mark in the end is means that they did his work, the Antichrist's work.
I just want to tell you, Manuel, I agree with you. I agree with you, and I appreciate you calling. But I will explain what you're saying only because I think I can say it a little quicker, and we're almost out of time. And what he is saying is that the mark in the hand and the forehead suggests the thoughts and the actions. A person's thoughts are indicated by his head, his actions indicated by his hand, and that those who have the mark of the beast in their forehead or hand are distinguished by having the thoughts and the actions of the satanic beast. And this is contrasted in Revelation with Revelation chapter 14, where the elect, the godly people, have the mark or the seal of God in their foreheads, which means, of course, that they have the thoughts, they think their minds and their actions are attuned with God rather than with the devil. And I'm pretty sure that's what you're saying, isn't it?
Well, I think we are not to be politically correct, but deny and say the truth, because the judgment starts in the house of the Lord. And Second John explains what is different. Yeah,
brother,
than
I can't have a complete Bible study from me right now. I would love to. I'd love to, but we only have a few minutes left. And so I'm going to thank you for your call. I think you made a good point. And I just can't really go on and on because there's another call I want to get to if we can. We only have about 2 minutes left. But Manuel, thank you for that call. I don't mean to cut anyone off, but we do have a very limited time together here. Mario from Los Angeles, you're our final caller of the day. Welcome.
Yes, Steve, thanks for taking my call. I was talking to a guy yesterday. He was pre-tribulation. I used to believe that that we will not go to the tribulation on earth as saints. But he was saying that I told him it was the day of the Lord, the passage was used in Thessalonians, because he was trying to say it was rapture. And I'm like, the word rapture is not in there. But he said that in that passage, he couldn't be talking about the coming of the Lord because the Lord will not touch down on earth. His feet will not place his feet on the earth. And so he was saying that was not the second coming or something like that.
In 1 Thessalonians chapter 4? Okay, I think what he's doing, he's just assuming that 1 Thessalonians 4 is talking about the rapture. And he's placing it before the tribulation, and he's saying, therefore, it is not the second coming, but Jesus will just come down to the clouds, call the church up, but he won't come down to the earth. That is not stated. The rapture is, in fact, stated. I mean, it's not called the rapture. It's not, that word is not used. But the rapture is described in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 16 through 18, but it is not said that it is pre-tribulational. Unfortunately, we don't have time to go any further. I'm going to have to just tell you, you're listening to The Narrow Path. You can go to my website, thenarrowpath.com, and have a great weekend. We'll talk again Monday. Sorry to be so brief on that last call.